the cutouts over the side of the truck, you'll be able to see the damage more clearly. We'll take photos in case we need the evidence.
Great, Lucas said. In the meantime, he jogged back to his SUV and pulled out a piece of what looked like white rubber. When he carried it back to the F-250, Lucas could see it was actually a cast made from the truck tire tracks they'd found on the mountainside where the logs had been dumped. Armstrong squatted next to the truck, held the cast up to one of the tires, and they all bent over to look.
"Same tires," he said. "They come as one of the standard options with the truck, but less than 30% are equipped with them. Not definitive, but supportive."
"Another straw on the camel's back," Bob said. The sides and front end of the truck bed had been fitted with a steel rack to give it more carrying capacity and better tie-down capability. Kerr walked along the side of the bed with a Sherlock Holmes-style magnifying glass. Halfway down she stopped, looked more closely, turned to Armstrong, and said,
"Carl, take a look."
Armstrong took the magnifying glass to look at what appeared to be nothing at all. He said,
"Huh," and, "You guys want to look?"
Lucas took the magnifying glass, and Armstrong took a mechanical pencil from his pocket and pointed at the truck and said,
"Right at the end of the pencil point."
Lucas looked, and under the glass could see three or four wispy beige threads clinging to a tiny nick in the steel rail.
"What am I looking at?"
"Those look exactly like the threads that were stuck to the padded side of the log. I'll kiss your ass if they aren't identical. We need to find as many as we can and collect them. A lab will tell us if they are the same."
Bob and Ray both took a look, and Bob said,
"That's the search warrant."
Lucas called Fort. Fort wrote the search warrant application for Ritter's apartment and the interior of the truck and drove it over to the judge's chambers. Getting the warrant back to Ritter's place took 3 boring hours. Lucas, Bob, Ray, Armstrong, and Kerr hung out in their vehicles in the parking lot, making occasional individual runs out to a Safeway supermarket for food, drinks, and magazines. They didn't need the search warrant to fit the F-250 templates to the side of the truck, so Armstrong and Kerr did that while the others watched and waited. The photography was interesting, in a way, for a while, and then they slipped back into a hot, sweating boredom. When Armstrong finished, he transferred his photos to a laptop and brought the laptop over to Lucas's Avoke. With Bob and Ray looking over their shoulders from the back seat, Armstrong ran through the high-res photos on the laptop screen, and the impact dent was plain enough. Kerr had been on the other side of the templates with a flash, which fired when Armstrong took the shot, illuminating the space between the templates and the truck.
"It's what you'd expect if they did what we think they did with the logs," Armstrong said. "I bet they don't even know that the truck was damaged."
Fort delivered the warrant himself, bringing along 4 additional marshals. 2 of the marshals were left in the parking lot to watch the truck. Armstrong and Kerr began collecting fiber samples from the truck and bagging them for the lab. Lucas, Bob, Ray, Fort, and the other 2 marshals went to Ritter's apartment. The 2 marshals specialized in searches. The first man, computers, the second, safes and lockboxes. There was no answer to their knocks, so they showed the search warrant to the apartment manager and ordered her to open Ritter's door. She squinted at Lucas and said,
"Hey, you're the marshal who got lost. You were lying to me when you were here before."
Lucas said, "Sorry." He was lying again. Their search warrant was sharply limited to records, both paper and computer files, and to weapons, since Ritter was suspected in the Douglas last shooting in the Twin Cities. Last had supposedly been shot with his girlfriend's gun, a fact not mentioned in the warrant application. The warrant specifically said that they were allowed to search for records that might be hidden in the apartment, which, for practical purposes, meant they could look at everything, but if they found something criminal that was not openly visible and was not a record or a weapon, it probably wouldn't make it into court. Ritter's apartment smelled of almost nothing except maybe pasta and kitchen cleaner. He lived a Spartan life except in three areas. He had a high-end, high-definition television which sat in front of a 7-foot couch. He had a high-end stereo system with a turntable in addition to a CD player and a load of fashionable vinyl records, and he had lots of guns. The guns were in a gun safe, as opposed to a real safe, in a closet. It was bolted to the floor, and the locks and safe specialist took no more than 5 minutes to get it open. Inside were 14 guns, 5 rifles, a tactical shotgun, and 8 handguns, none of them cheap, in a variety of sizes and calibers. 2 of the handguns were equipped with screw-on silencers. The marshal noted the serial numbers on the silencers and checked with the ATF computer records and learned that they were both licensed to Ritter and so were legal.
"That's a shame," he told Lucas. "That would have been a nice round federal felony if they weren't registered."
They also found about 1,000 rounds of ammo for the guns. The apartment had a small, tidy kitchen with 2 tables. One table was for eating. The other was a gun repair and reloading station. Ritter had an inexpensive Dell desktop computer and a small multipurpose printer scanner. The computer had no password. All its software was the standard stuff that came with the machine, plus Microsoft Word and a privacy application called Windex. That was it. There were no emails, there was no browser history, there were no documents, there were no cookies. The computer specialist Marshall explained that Windex was a Windows software package that could remove any trace of the computer's use at the end of each session. Click on the Windex icon and whatever you'd been doing was lost to history.
"It all goes to where television pictures go when you turn off the TV," the marshal said.
Ritter also had 3 black 2-drawer file cabinets in the office. Ray worked through those while Bob and Lucas prowled the apartment, trying the common hiding places and plugging a lamp into each outlet to make sure it was operable. Outlet caches were currently fashionable among the crooked. Lucas found the first useful piece of information. Ritter had a modest selection of clothing, mostly athletic and outdoorsy, including camo cargo pants and jackets, along with a dark suit suitable for funerals, 3 sport coats in varied textures and shades of blue, 3 pairs of gray or black slacks, 4 pairs of boots, and 1 pair of black dress shoes. Lucas was patting down the jackets when he felt something stiff in the inside breast pocket of one of the sport coats. When he pulled it out, it was a plastic hotel key card. On the back was a logo of the Hilton Garden Inn Omaha East Council Bluffs. Ritter had been in Omaha.
"Bag that baby," Bob said.
"Think we can call it a record?" Lucas asked.
"Fuck yeah."
Of the 6 file cabinet drawers Ray was working, 2 drawers were a jumble of office supplies and computer cables, the other 4 a collection of investment and bank statements and employment and tax records.
"I'm looking at it, and he does have some money, about maybe $800,000 in cash and investments, if I'm not missing anything. He seems to spend a lot of time overseas, and I wouldn't be surprised if he gets free food and housing, along with a nice salary that he can't spend anywhere over there. So his investments don't seem outlandish. You'd need a good accountant to tell you for sure, and I'm not one."
Sitting on one of the file cabinets was an innocuous framed photo showing Ritter with two male friends and two women in what looked like a park. He had his arm around the shoulder of one of the women, who might have been who they'd seen at the Wily Rat nightclub. She was half turned away from the camera, her face obscured, but Lucas could see that she was short and dark-haired. Fort had left with the computer specialist a half hour after they started the search. The locks and safes guy was helping go through the apartment inch by inch when he took a call from one of the two marshals who were at the truck. He listened for a moment, then said, "Hey, Lucas, Ritter's down at the truck. He just showed up." Lucas took the phone and asked, "He's driving the Miata?" "Yeah." "Don't let him leave," Lucas said. "We'll be right down." "He's already parked," the marshal said. "He's coming up, and he's pissed." "Walk with him," Lucas said. Ritter was at the door 5 minutes later. He was a bit shorter than average, but muscular, dark-haired, dark-eyed, dark-complected, with three parallel white scars on one side of his face that might have been inflicted by a woman's fingernails, or, in Ritter's case, shrapnel. He was wearing a black T-shirt, tan cotton nylon cargo pants, light hiking boots, and a black ball cap. He picked out Lucas as the main fed, demanded, "What the hell is going on?" Lucas said, "We believe you may be involved in the attempted assassination of Senator Porter Smalls that resulted in the murder of Mrs. Cecily Whitehead. We're looking for evidence in that case." Ritter nearly did a movie double take. "What the fuck you been smoking, man?" "Don't smoke," Lucas said. "We have a lot of questions for you." Ritter reached down to one of his cargo pants, and it was Lucas who reacted, moving a hand toward his side. Ritter froze, then said, "Wallet." Lucas nodded, and Ritter extracted a trifold wallet from his pocket, took a card out, and handed it to Lucas. "I might ask a question or two myself, but I'm not going to answer any, not without an okay from my lawyer. That's my lawyer's name, address, and direct phone number. I'm going to call him now, unless I'm under arrest." "Not yet," Lucas said. "But you will be. Go make your call." "Can I leave the apartment to make the call?" "Yes, you're free to go, but our search warrant covers your vehicles, so you can't take those until we're done with them. If we find any evidence pertinent to the case, the cars will be impounded." "God damn it, that's not right," Ritter said. "Do I get reimbursed for the cost of a rental car?" "I wouldn't hold your breath," Lucas said. Ritter said, "There are two pistols in the safe with suppressors. Both are registered with the ATF. "We know," Lucas said. "That was a disappointment." Ritter held Lucas's eye momentarily and said, "I'll remember you." "I think you already met my wife," Lucas said. And Ritter blinked. Ritter turned and left. Ritter had committed at least one murder, and probably two, but he wasn't a professional or career criminal. He was essentially a soldier, a guy who killed people under orders, or even of his own volition, but who didn't have to worry about prosecution. Stupid crooks would have reacted to Lucas's comment about weather, but a professional would have allowed a puzzled wrinkle to appear on his forehead. Ritter had blinked. It was called a tell by poker players, and, as far as Lucas was concerned, it was as good as an admission of guilt. Couldn't take it to a jury, but it was there. Ray eased up and said, "Decided to go with Mr. Subtle, huh?" "I wasn't going to get anything from being Mr. Nice, and we don't have enough to bust him yet, so a push never hurt." As the search wound down, Lucas walked around the building and found Armstrong wrapping up his inspection of the truck. Kerr was working on Ritter's other vehicle, a fire-engine red Mazda MX-5 Miata. A very nice car, Lucas thought. A driver's car, probably even more than a Porsche, at about one-fourth the price. The interior of the truck hadn't produced anything. It did have a GPS, but all the history had been wiped clean. That was evidence of a kind, but not useful.
"We got enough threads to braid a string," Armstrong said, "but only from the right side. I think we'll be able to produce some hard evidence that the fabric is identical to the fabric that was used to pad the logs.
How soon will we know?"
"I'll squeeze the lab guy. I'll know something tomorrow, but we can go after DNA to nail it down, and that'll take a few days, or even a couple of weeks."
Would it speed things up if a U.S. senator called and asked about it?
"For sure," Armstrong said.
There was nothing in the Mazda. Bob had come along with Lucas and said, "I gotta believe that the guy has a laptop. Everybody has a laptop, including Ritter. Nothing in his hands when he got out of the Miata, nothing in the car. I wonder where he ditched it." Lucas looked around the parking lot. The lot behind the apartment house wasn't visible from the street. Ritter hadn't pulled in and pulled back out because somebody would have noticed a bright red sports car coming and going without stopping. "Wouldn't have had a chance to throw it out the window," Lucas said. "Wonder if somebody tipped him off that we were here." "Mrs. Snyder?" Snyder, the apartment manager.
"We warned her, and she struck me as a woman who knew when to stay warned."
"Well, look at all those windows," Bob said, and they both looked up at the back of the apartment complex. "We know Ritter's got a girlfriend, and if she lives up there, she might have given him a ring."
"Probably what happened," Lucas agreed.
"I'll ask Snyder. Maybe she'd know something about a relationship."
"Be nice if we could find a laptop," Bob said. "The computer guys might be able to find out if it was used in either Omaha or Minneapolis, even if the messages were erased."
Ray came around and asked, "What's next, boss?" "We get the truck towed to the Arlington impound lot. We have the names of four people probably involved in hitting weather, and those four are also probably involved in the Smalls attack," Lucas said. "Tomorrow we'll track them down. Keep the pressure up." 16. 10 o'clock was a good time for a raid, even if this wasn't exactly a raid. At 10 o'clock, the employees who were running late should be at the office, but it was too early for lunch. Ray had filled out the return on the James Ritter search warrant the night before, and Fort would file it. There wasn't much to report, although the hotel key card was seized as documentary evidence in the case. Lucas, Bob, and Ray walked out into a bright blue day and hit the greasy spoon at 9 o'clock, talked about what they would do that morning, and a few minutes after 10, rolled into the parking lot at Heracles' Virginia headquarters in an area called Crystal City. Airliners were landing nearby, and Lucas thought they might be close to Reagan National Airport. Heracles was only one of a half dozen tenants of a nondescript 15-story green glass cube that just as easily could have been a parking structure as an office building. The parking lot, landscaped with relentlessly green, unidentifiable bushes as nondescript as the building itself, was two-thirds full. An overweight guard in a dull gray uniform was patrolling the parking lot, and when they pulled into visitors' slots, he walked over and asked Lucas,
"Do you have an appointment here?"
"No, but we do have business here," Lucas said, holding up his ID. "We'll be speaking to some of the tenants."
"No problem, bub," the guard said. "I'd make sure nobody stole your hubcaps if you had hubcaps."
"Keep an eye on the wheels, then," Ray said.
"I'll do that," the guard said.
As they walked up to the building's entrance, Bob said, "Gonna be hot."
"You mean talking to Heracles or walking around outside?" Lucas asked.
"Outside," Bob said, wiping his forehead with his fingertips.
A reception counter faced the building's front door, with a steel fence extending from the counter to the walls on either side. The fence was penetrated on the left by three steel turnstiles. A receptionist, wearing a Kelly green dress and a matching pillbox hat, sat behind the counter, while a guard, this one with a gun on his hip, stood between two of the turnstiles. They again showed their IDs, signed in, and got badges from the receptionist that allowed them through the turnstiles. Lucas said to her, "You don't have to announce us," and she nodded but looked perplexed since announcing was her job, so he clarified, "Don't announce us." The guard asked, "You here to arrest somebody?" Lucas said, "Don't know." Heracles was on the second floor. Lucas and Ray took the elevator up since the fire door on the stairway was one way, out and locked. Bob waited for the next elevator to keep an eye on the door, the guard, and the receptionist. Lucas always preferred showing up unannounced to see the unpracticed reaction of the person he was interviewing. In this case, though, the search of Ritter's apartment might have served as its own notice. The entrance to the Heracles office was a double glass door that faced the elevator. Lucas could see no other glass doors or greeting signs along the hallway that stretched in both directions to the end of the building. Heracles apparently had the whole floor, he thought. A young woman sat at an expansive desk on the wall opposite the glass doors. There were four red-orange visitors' chairs, two on each side of the reception lobby, non-occupied. When Lucas pulled the door, it didn't move. The woman spoke into what must have been a microphone embedded in the desk.
"Can I help you?"
Speakers were set into the walls on either side of the door. Lucas said, "U.S. Marshals, open up, please," and held up his badge. The woman hesitated, and Lucas said, "Open up now, please." She reached out to a black object on her desk, and the doors unlocked with a quiet clank. Lucas pulled the door open, went through, trailed by Ray, and said, "We want to speak to Mr. George Claxon, Mr. John McCoy, and Mr. Kerry Moore." The receptionist looked frightened.
"Can I tell them what this is about?"
Lucas said, "No, I'll tell them. Just tell them we're here."
"Mr.
Marshal Lucas Davenport and Marshal Ray Givens, Marshal Bob Matisse, will be here in a minute." The woman nodded, picked up her phone, pressed a button, and said in a hushed voice,
"There are three U.S. Marshals here to speak to Mr. Claxon, John McCoy, and Kerry Moore,"
followed a few seconds later by,
"They won't say."
Bob stepped out of the elevator, and the woman unlocked the door for him. Bob said, "You guys got a lot of security." The receptionist said, a nervous shimmer in her voice,
"We have a lot of defense contracts."
The reception lobby had two doors into the back, one on each side of the receptionist's desk. The one on the left popped open, and a middle-aged woman in a gray dress said,
"Marshals, you wanted to see Mr. Claxon? Follow me, please."
They followed her through what might have been an insurance office, but not a heavily staffed one. A warren of perhaps 50 waist and shoulder-high cubicles in a room the size of a basketball court. Each cubicle housed a computer, with perhaps a third of them occupied by either a man or a woman looking at the screen. A couple of the occupants looked up as the woman led Lucas, Bob, and Ray through the cubicle farm, but most paid no attention. The woman half turned as they were walking and said,
"I'm Mr. Claxon's personal assistant. Mr. McCoy isn't here today. He's at Camp Peary. Mr. Moore is here somewhere, maybe in planning. I'll go find him. Mr. Claxon is waiting in his office."
The receptionist might have been surprised to see them, but this woman wasn't, Lucas thought. Their visit wasn't unexpected. Claxon's office was a two-room corner suite with views of the airport. The outer room had three secretarial-style desks with computers, two of them occupied by older women who watched the marshals with curiosity but said nothing. The third desk, a large one, probably belonged to Claxon's PA, who was escorting them. In the inner office was a wide swath of thick blue carpet, the walls decorated with plaques, photographs, one wildlife painting on each wall, and two mounted deer heads. A wide walnut desk sat diagonally in the corner. Claxon himself was seated at a computer that perched on its own stand to the side of his desk. He looked up as they entered, waved them toward a half-circle of chairs facing the desk. There were two pistols lying on the desk, one a model 1911-45, the other a Browning High Power with a foot-long Marine K-bar fighting knife sitting between them. The knife had the initials G.C. stamped on its well-oiled leather sheath. Claxon was a fast-touch typist. He rattled through a paragraph of text while Lucas, Bob, and Ray were settling into their chairs. He checked the screen, touching it with the tip of an index finger, then hit two keys and the text vanished. He turned, crossed his hands on his desk, and said, "Marshals, what can I do for you?" Claxon resembled a character actor that Lucas had seen in any number of movies, thin, balding, with quarter-sized freckles spotting his shiny scalp, but with a soft face rather than one with athletic contours. He wore rimless glasses, a gray suit, white shirt, and a light blue tie with stars on it. "Lucas, did you fly your personal plane to Omaha 2 weeks ago with James Ritter, John McCoy, and Kerry Moore on board?" Claxon lifted his hands. "I might as well lay out the rules right now. I'm aware that you went after one of our employees, Jim Ritter, yesterday afternoon, some ridiculous accusation that he was involved in an attempted assassination of Senator Porter Smalls. I spoke to our company lawyer. We take care of our personnel, and he will be representing Jim if you have any more questions. Our attorney has also advised me simply not to answer any questions that might feed your conspiracy theories. Yes, I flew to Omaha. I was there for a week of business, more or less. I fly my own plane, and there was nobody else on board. I won't reveal the nature of the business because that's a private matter that would possibly reveal classified military information. So, I don't believe we have anything more to talk about. We understand that John McCoy is not here in the building, but Kerry Moore may be. We need to talk to Mr. Moore," Lucas said. "He's here. You can speak to him, but he's taken advice from the same attorney that I have." "He won't have anything to say," Claxon said. He looked out the door of his office and said, "Here's Kerry now." Kerry Moore, probably 35 years old, was a muscular man with short-cropped hair in what seemed to be a favored Washington paramilitary uniform, tan cargo pants, light-colored boots, and a light-colored long-sleeved pullover shirt. He nodded at Claxon and said, "You rang?" Claxon waved in the direction of the marshals. "These are the marshals Jim told us about." Moore nodded at them and said, "Well, Rick Brown told me that talking about anything might bring trouble, so I guess I don't want to talk with you, unless there's an attorney in the room." "Rick is our attorney," Claxon said to Lucas. Speaking to Moore, Ray began, "You don't have anything to worry about." "Honey, you gotta know that's bullshit," Moore said. "You guys go on one of these snipe hunts, and it winds up on CNN, where they're pulling apart every word, looking for every possible meaning. The next thing you know, you got a noose around your neck and cameras chasing you down the street.
If you want me to talk, we're going to need a lawyer in the room.
So you're not unwilling to talk, Bob said.
Moore considered and said,
Not entirely unwilling, but you got to know Rick Brown. He's going to say no as soon as you open your mouth.
Lucas looked at the two of them and said, Okay, dead end then. But I'll tell you guys, this isn't the end of it. You tried to kill the U.S. Senator, and you murdered two people.
No, no, did not, Claxon said, slapping his desk.
I absolutely reject any such notion. You say one word about it in public, we will sue everybody in sight. Our livelihood depends on our reputation, and if you begin slandering us with that... We did not have anything to do with any of that.
Lucas said, We'll see. In the meantime, I'll tell you that we haven't made any ridiculous accusations against Ritter. Those were the words you used. I will tell you that we have substantial evidence that he was involved in the assassination attempt. We believe we know why. We believe we know the others involved. We have a bit of lab evidence we're waiting to get back, and then we'll be here with an arrest warrant.
Fuck you, Claxon said.
Lucas, Ray, and Bob stood up to go. Bob nodded at the pistols on the desk and asked Claxon, Are those weapons loaded?
Claxon snarled at him.
Of course they are. If they weren't, they wouldn't be weapons. They'd be paperweights.
They took the elevator down, and Ray said to Lucas, That was embarrassing. They did everything but kick us in the ass. But you don't look all that unhappy.
I'm not.
All we've got is evidence against Ritter, and he's not the guy we want, Lucas said. We want to go up from there, and now we've put a skunk in with the chickens. One way or another, they'll react.
Oh, we need to put a hold on their passports in case one of them decides to run for it.
Your man Fort should be able to handle that, Bob said.
We wait for lab results?
What do we do while we're waiting? Ray asked as they got out of the elevator. Play pinochle?
Lucas said, Bob's a camera freak and you like art, so Bob can go take pictures and you can go over to the National Gallery and look at art. But keep your phone handy.
We did most of that while you were gone, Ray said. What are you going to do?
I've got a fitting with my tailor, Lucas said.
Bob and Ray both stopped walking to peer at him, and Ray said, You're joking, right?
No, I'm not. We've got some downtime, so it seems like a reasonable thing to do, Lucas said.
Bob, if one of these assholes kills you, you'll have a new suit to get buried in.
There's that, Lucas said.
They went back to the hotel where Ray took the rented Tahoe and headed for the National Gallery. Bob got his camera, but asked Lucas if he could tag along to the tailor shop, and that was fine with Lucas. Parking was rare around the shop, so they took a cab. At Figueroa and Prince, Lucas was met by Ted, who smiled, reached out to shake hands, and said,
Lucas, happy to see you back. We have a preliminary cut. There were some interesting discussions here about how to accommodate the pistol.
Lucas introduced Bob, who took a chair to watch the fitting, and, after a few minutes, got up to wander around the shop, checking out the suits on display, the accessory racks, and finally the fabrics themselves. Lucas was trying on the first cut of a wool winter suit when he noticed Bob talking to another one of the salesmen. When Lucas was finished with his fitting, he found Bob draped in a pale blue crepe-like material and looking squint-eyed into a mirror. Ted walked over and said,
I think we can do better.
What does that mean? Bob asked Lucas.
It means that color makes you look like a fucking boxcar, Lucas said. You ought to have them embroider Burlington Northern on your back.
I might not have put it quite that way, Ted said, to Bob. We should spend a while talking about your goals.
My goal is to have a good-fitting suit that I can wear in southern Louisiana, because I've never had one of those in my life.
Ted considered that and said to the other salesman, Not one suit, I think two.
They wound up spending 3 hours in the store, and when they left, Lucas, looking both ways before letting the door close behind him, said, Well, that was a quick way to blow $6,000. I'm proud of you.
Bob shrugged.
I've got a good job. I don't care about cars, don't gamble, don't chase too many women or use drugs. I've got a few extra bucks, and I've never had a suit that fit right, so why not?
Lucas clapped him on the back.
Like I said, I'm proud of you. I'm serious. You, my friend, are gonna look terrific. You'll be able to hold your head up, even in New Orleans. I like that part about working around the gun. I never knew any of that shit. I'll tell you, though, I ain't spending $4,000 for a pair of wingtips.
Lucas said, You're standing on a slippery slope, Bob. I predict there are wingtips in your future, but not for 3 years. Once you go over, you'll never go back.
I heard somebody say that about gay sex, Bob said.
Almost the same thing, Lucas said. They're very close.
17. Parrish arrived at Grant's house, and when Grant came to the door, the housekeeper had been sent home. He asked,
Who's here?
George, Grant said. We're in the skiff.
Parrish followed her through the house, past the heavy door to the basement, which silently slid closed behind them, and down the stairs. Claxon was spread across the sofa. He was wearing aviator sunglasses and an unwrinkled blue-striped seersucker suit. A fashionably battered leather briefcase sat at his feet. Parrish took a seat and asked,
What's up?
Grant looked at Claxon and said,
The electronics say he's carrying a big chunk of metal, but no electronics other than a cell phone.
He's got a gun, Claxon said.
Jesus, Parrish said. Then, So what?
Grant slid open her desk drawer, took out the 9mm, and laid it on the desktop.
Just good to know.
Parrish shook his head. I'm not going to shoot anyone. I assume you're doing video or sound. I hope it spools to something you can erase.
It does, Grant said. Of course it does.
Parrish. Okay. So, what's up?
Ritter is what's up, Claxon said. It looks like the Marshal Service might have enough on him to put him in the truck that hit Smalls.
And killed Whitehead, Grant added. It's like I'm trapped in a circus. It all sounds good. Then the clowns show up.
How do you know this? Parrish asked. That the Marshal Service has... I have a friend at the DOJ. Claxon said.
So what do we do?
Move Ritter out of here? Parrish asked.
Both Grant and Claxon looked at him without saying a word, and Parrish finally said,
You're thinking of something more permanent?
Not only that, Claxon said. We're thinking that one of the three of us has to do it. Senator Grant and I took a vote, and you won.
Wait, Parrish croaked. I've never done that.
Yeah, but you can. Maybe you never had the opportunity, Claxon said. I've seen you at the range. What's the problem?
I've never done that.
We're all in serious trouble here, Claxon said, standing up, leaning over Parrish. Jim is a good guy, but he's looking at life without parole if the marshals get to him. And they're close. They want him, but they want us more. If they break him, if they make a deal with him, all of us are done. He has to go. Senator Grant needs to be in a public place when he goes away, and so do I. That leaves you.
I can't fucking believe this, Parrish said. There's gotta be some other way.
Grant said, there is no better way, not for George or me. If you get caught, well, too bad. Claxton and I'll say you'd gone rogue and we had no idea what you were up to. If you don't get caught, we've sealed off an existential problem, a problem that could kill all three of us.
But, no buts, it's decided, Claxton said. Gotta be right away. Try not to step on your dick. Do that and we'll throw you and your dick under the bus.
Parrish argued, but Grant and Claxton stonewalled him. It had to be done. Parrish left in a heavy sweat. He'd never been an operator in the military sense of the word. He'd worked in supply, in logistics, even when he was with the CIA. If you needed to get 1,000 M4s to Iraq by Monday, he could do it, though a few crates might fall off the back of the truck. He'd known lots of real operators, though, and had provided expedited supplies for special operations forces. A dozen former operators hung around Heracles, coming and going without saying much. He liked to think he could hang with them. And Claxton had seen him at the range. Parrish liked to shoot and was good at it. He liked the whole ritual of handling the weapon, cleaning it, the signature smell of the Hoppy's gun cleaner, the acrid odor of the brass brushes. He left Grant's skiff frightened and exhilarated. Had to be done, and now he'd find out what he was all about. He had some thinking to do as well. If they really and truly wanted to wall off the problem, he might go next. Something to worry about. He called Ritter.
We may have a problem in St. Paul. We need to talk.
Where?
My place.
When Parrish bought his Georgetown home, he'd bought the best address he could afford, which turned out to be a late 19th or early 20th century townhouse that was structurally sound, but internally a mess. He'd taken home improvement classes at a community college and, over 3 years, had cautiously upgraded the place. The project of which he was most proud of involved a closet. It had been in a bedroom, and he'd converted it into an office. He'd stripped off the molding surrounding the original door and replaced the door itself with a heavy metal core blank that he'd fitted flush with the wall. He'd painted the blank to match the wall and attached a bookcase as a front. This new door had a lock 6 feet up from the floor with a heavy bolt which ensured that the bookcase wouldn't move no matter how hard somebody pushed or pulled on it. Because the lock was set right above one of the bookcase's shelves, it couldn't be seen except by somebody standing on a chair or an NBA center. Unlock the door, the bookcase swung out to reveal the closet, which was full of goodies. Parrish thought of himself as prepared, as an operator, as a survivor. He loved the idea of a hidden room in his house. He had 2 combat-style pump shotguns and 2 black rifles inside the closet, along with 12 pistols, including 2 with suppressors. He also had an entire drawer full of knives, another drawer full of ammo, 2 compound bows with 100 carbon fiber arrows, body armor, Delta-style helmets, a pair of night vision goggles, 2 tactical backpacks, 3 different kinds of camo uniforms, a variety of equipment bags, a gas mask, and even a straw cowboy hat. Much of it, not the cowboy hat, had been stolen during his army tours in the Middle East. Since he was involved in logistics, he had no problem getting it back to the States.
None of the firearms were registered in Washington, so possession of them was a crime. He wasn't too worried, because the district was awash in guns. Still, if the cops wanted him for something else and tore the house apart, possession of the guns could land him in prison. He selected one of the silenced pistols, a Kimber 45, his favorite. He was ready, but nervous. Once upon a time in Iraq, Parrish had been on a convoy out of Baghdad headed north toward Balad Air Base. They were passing through a hamlet an hour into the trip when an improvised explosive device, an artillery shell, took out a truck three trucks ahead of his. There was one good lookout nearby, a two-story mud brick building that stood in the shade of a copse of palm trees, and two real operators ran toward it while two more hosed down the exposed windows. A moment later, there was a brief burst of gunfire from behind the building as the operators cut down a running man. Parrish, exiting the truck, could see there wasn't much more going on. Everybody was out of the trucks, and a medic was working on the injured up ahead. He saw the two operators moving around behind the building. He went that direction, where he found them standing over a downed man. Parrish skidded to a stop, walked over, and looked at the man, who was bleeding heavily from multiple leg and stomach wounds. He asked, "He going to make it?" One of the operators said, "Don't think so." The second one asked, "You ever killed anybody, Jack?" Parrish said, "No." The man handed Parrish his M4. "Here, go ahead." Parrish took the gun, looked at the wounded man on the ground, who was looking up at him and rocking back and forth, his legs tight to his chest. Parrish asked, "He's the guy who touched off the IED?" "Probably," the operator said. "He tried to get rid of his cell phone, threw it over there." He nodded toward a clump of waist-high, trashy-looking palms. "We found it." The first man held up the cheap cell. "No reason to do that unless he used it to trigger the bomb," Parrish said. "Okay." He stepped back, turned the rifle on the wounded man. The man said, "No." And as Parrish focused on his heart area, the operator snatched the gun back.
"Jesus Christ, Jack, it was a joke."
The operator was freaked.
"Jesus."
The medics took care of all the wounded in the convoy, but by the time they got to the man, he was dead. Just as well he was out of his misery, Parrish thought, as the medevac Black Hawks dusted off the bombing scene and headed for the hospital at Balad. The fact was, there'd been nothing sexual about the situation, but Parrish got a hard-on when he thought about it. If only he'd had a chance to pull the trigger. Parrish told Ritter to park two blocks away and to walk in and to check for surveillance on the way. "There are always parking spaces behind the cafe, and you can get in and out of the lot without being seen."
"Why your place?"
"Because I stripped the whole house down myself, and it's clean. We need to talk where nobody can hear us. With all the shit you guys have over at Heracles, I'd be surprised if there aren't microphones hidden in the office chairs."
"See you at 9, Ritter said.
Ritter was an athletic guy of average height, with black eyes, tight-cut black hair, and a dark Mediterranean complexion. In Somalia, at a short distance and wearing a kamis, he could pass for a native, and had. Parrish had been told that Ritter and his twin brother had finished first and second in a Nebraska statewide high school cross-country championship. Ritter left his car in the lot behind the Jitterbug Coffee and Cafe. Parrish was right. It was dark back there. If he ever needed to mug somebody for money, Ritter thought, he'd stake out the Jitterbug. The cafe wasn't cheap. It was full of prosperous-looking people with Macintosh Pros, and they all had pencil necks.
easy pickings. Ritter took 15 minutes to walk to Parrish's house, circling the block twice. Been better, he thought, if only he had a dog. He wondered briefly if Washington had a pit bull rental agency. He saw nothing moving. The fact was, if the marshals were watching Parrish, they'd probably be on a roof somewhere, or in an apartment across the street. They wouldn't be parked in a car where the cops might roust them. 15 minutes after he left the jitterbug, he rang the bell at Parrish's. When Parrish bought his house, the floors were either wooden or covered with carpet. The carpet would soak up blood like a sponge, but the wood, always well waxed, would repel it. The wooden floor in the kitchen had been refinished for the sale. It was worn smooth, but shone with the golden glow of old chestnut, and that was where Parrish decided he would kill Ritter. Parrish didn't cook, but had 3 cookbooks on a shelf under a kitchen cabinet. He put the gun between 2 of the books, cocked, safety off, a round of G2 RIP 95 ACP in the chamber. There'd be no point in waiting, he thought. When Ritter rang the doorbell, Parrish popped a chicken pot pie in the microwave, turned the microwave on, and went to answer the door. The cooking pie would fill the kitchen with a homely aroma that might ease any suspicions in Ritter's mind. Parrish was more tense than he'd expected. He'd realized, as he got the gun ready, that if he screwed it up, Ritter would kill him. Ritter slipped inside, and Parrish shut the door behind him and asked, "See anybody?" "No, but if you've got professionals watching you, I wouldn't. You think there might be somebody?" "Not really, but since last week, we've got a problem. I'm cooking dinner. Come on back to the kitchen and I'll tell you about it." Ritter followed him down the hall to the kitchen. Walking with his back to Ritter made Parrish itch between the shoulder blades, but he focused on the job. In the kitchen, the pot pie was beginning to heat up. Ritter said, "Smells good." Parrish opened the microwave, and as he did, he said, "There's milk, water, beer, and Pepsi in the refrigerator. Get me a Pepsi and whatever you want." "'Kay, what's the problem?" Ritter asked. As he answered, Ritter opened the refrigerator, the door swinging wide between himself and Parrish. Parrish pulled the gun out from between the books, and when Ritter shut the refrigerator, holding a 2-quart carton of milk and a bottle of Pepsi, Parrish shot him twice in the chest, one of the slugs going through the milk carton, spraying milk over Ritter's face and chest. Ritter staggered, looking blankly at Parrish, then he dropped the Pepsi and the milk and twisted and fell face first to the floor, where he spasmed for several seconds and finally went quiet. Though silenced, the shots had been loud in the small kitchen. Not loud enough for his neighbors to hear, but loud enough that Parrish's ears rang for a few seconds. Parrish looked down at the body and felt some chemical flushing through his body. Not adrenaline, something else, something even more primitive. A kind of breath-robbing hormone, maybe a testosterone variant. Whatever it is that makes warriors exult in a kill. It produced a kind of joy. Parrish stood still, closed his eyes, let himself feel it. Before he'd left Grant's house and the skiff, Parrish, Grant, and Claxon had talked about what to do with Ritter's body. Claxon had suggested taking it out into the woods somewhere and burying it. Grant said she'd let the professionals work that out, but mentioned that she'd known of a situation where that had worked. Parrish said he'd think some of something, but in truth, he'd already thought of it. Given the number of cops around D.C. and the surrounding countryside, he wasn't going to move a body any farther than he had to,
and sure as shit wasn't going to stumble around in the woods, in the dark, with a shovel and a gunny sack. He knew where the body would be going before he ever left Grant's skiff. Parrish hurriedly stripped all the ID off the body, wallet, telephone, Rolex, an army ring with a blue stone, set it aside, took a contractor's trash bag out of the cupboard, knelt, and pulled it over Ritter's upper body. Ritter began shaking again as he did that, brain cells dying. He pulled another bag over Ritter's legs, rolled the body over to look at the floor. There was a pink smear of blood mixed with milk. Parrish, scrubbing with household cleaner, wiped the blood and milk up with a paper towel, making sure he had gotten it all. He remembered to pick up the 45 shells. Once he was on the highway, he'd throw them out the window. When he was done, he looked at the bagged body, then went on with the worst of it. The killing had been reasonably sanitary and drama-free. But if the body should be found, it would be best to delay identification as long as possible. He got a cleaver out of the hardware door and cut the third joint off each of Ritter's fingers, grimacing at the sound of the cleaver going through bone and tendon. He set the severed fingertips aside on a sheet of saran wrap, carried them to the bathroom. He flushed three at a time down the toilet, four with the last flush. When he was satisfied, and still with the strength and energy from whatever hormone he'd stirred up, he dragged Ritter's body down the stairs to the garage tucked under the house and lifted it into the back of his Jeep. Almost forgot his own phone. He called Grant. She picked up, and neither of them said anything. After a minute had passed, he hung up and carried the phone upstairs and put it on the kitchen counter. He drove across the river to a brew pub called Applejack's Burger and Beer, which happened to be near a metro station. The place had no cameras overlooking its dumpster, no windows. He parked next to the dumpster, looked for people out walking, and, in another 10-second burst of energy, boosted Ritter out of the Jeep and into the dumpster, where he landed almost soundlessly on a pile of cardboard and garbage. He'd taken Ritter's car keys and telephone. He crushed the phone under his foot, pulled out the battery, threw the pieces in the dumpster. 5 seconds later, he was out of the parking lot and on his way back to Georgetown. He dropped the phone battery out the car window along with the 45 shells, and after parking in his garage and checking the back of the Jeep for any traces of blood, he walked to the Jitterbug Cafe, clicked the key fob, and spotted the flashing lights of Ritter's Mazda. He drove the Mazda carefully to the metro station near the body dump site, parked it, and took the train back to Washington, to Foggy Bottom. He walked home from there, a bit more than a mile. A mile was nothing. He whistled most of the way, fighting back the adrenaline surging through him while reliving the shooting mentally in split-second frames. Nobody, he decided, could have done it better. At home, he called Claxon on his cell phone. Claxon didn't answer, as planned. The call alone from Parrish's number meant that everything had gone well. He hadn't liked seeing Jim go, but they'd sealed off the problem, and he'd gotten the thrill of a lifetime. He hoped to do it again someday. 18. When Allah wants to mess with a perfectly good murder, he doesn't hesitate. Jassim Nagi, a moderately faithful Islamic man of Arabic descent born in Atlantic City, who carried with him the full faith and credit of the New Jersey accent, drove a garbage truck. Not a humble garbage truck. It was a 2-year-old, 40-cubic-yard McNeilus front loader painted bright green,
and it took some skill to operate. At 6 o'clock in the dawn's early light, Nagi maneuvered through Applejack's empty parking lot, picked up the dumpster, and when the load dumped in the cargo box, he heard a loud bang as something large and metallic hit the bottom.